The Guardian.
Hello, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis, and in this week's show, emo teen sensations Paramore talk to us about world domination and not letting the haters get them down.
To get positive reviews that just really are respectful and respectable, like, feels like more people notice us for our music now than anything else, and I love that.
The Singles Club features new tracks from LCD Sound System and Nicki Minaj and a Mark Kapani reissue. And we remember the brilliant Malcolm McLaren, who passed away last week. We'll be speaking about his career as an artist, as well as being the brains behind the punk movement, with the help of Sylvain Sylvain from the New York Dolls.
I always thought that the most important musician in the Sex Pistols was actually Malcolm McLaren. You know, he was the biggest star in the Sex Pistols.
That's all in Music Weekly. Welcome to Rosie Swash.
I thought that was like, welcome to Rosie Swash. Rather than yeah, welcome, Rosie Swash.
You're welcome to Rosie Swash.
Hello, Alexis.
How you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm not too bad. And back again, it's Rebecca Nicholson.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm all right, thanks.
First up today, we're getting all emo on your ass. Paramore are the punk pop phenomenon from Nashville, whose third album, Brand New Eyes, shifted more copies in the US than Mariah Carey's last record. They are massive. And while it might not be to your tastes, or my tastes, or indeed anybody's tastes, apart from the 4 million people who bought their last records, they're clearly somebody's tastes, we thought it would be fun to talk to them. Rebecca, you met up with singer Hayley Williams.
I did. They are scarily popular with the kids. I went to see them at Wembley in December, and it was like being a school disco, a massive emo school disco. Although you can't really call them
that sounds
emo.
Brilliant.
Yeah, emo is, you know, emo's gone. I don't think they like being called emo.
Really?
Yeah.
So, what did you ask her about when you met her?
I asked her how she felt about Paramore's growing fan base around the world.
It's crazy. Our first show here was, you know, a sold out show. Now we're doing Wembley, and, you know, before that it was like Brixton, and it's crazy when we come here, but we were just in Australia, and we were in New Zealand and Singapore and Japan. Japan's actually, it's different because we play festivals and have these massive crowds, and it's like such a really cool mixture of people. And our fans, you know, we still haven't fully, we don't fully know our fan base there yet because we've only been there twice. And then our own shows were much smaller. They actually felt a lot like, you know, those little punk rock shows. And it was really cool. I have a lot of male fans in Japan, which makes for a really aggressive and fun show. And, you know, it's interesting there. And then going to Australia where, you know, we're one of the headlining acts for the festival, Soundwave. And that was cool. It was just a total change of pace from Japan.
Think the typical Paramore fan is? Is it easy for you to spot a kind of type?
It was particularly easy when we started getting a little bit of success, because then I think we were a little bit more pigeonholed into one corner. You know, it was like, you know, we didn't have as many songs, we didn't have as many albums, so it was kind of like, we are what we are, and this is kind of all we have to show you. And so our fans kind of, they were all from a certain scene, wore a certain kind of clothes. I mean, you know, they fit into a mold, and there was nothing wrong with that, and we never faulted it, but we're really stoked that now it's kind of reaching out far, you know, like it's a little harder to spot fans now.
Do you think it's hard to define the Paramore sound now, or harder now than it was in the first days?
To us, it's always kind of just been, this is Paramore, like this is rock music, this is pop music, it's pop punk, it's kind of whatever people want to call it. But, you know, now I've started to read in like different reviews of our albums, like people aren't really calling us emo anymore, which is nice, because when we first came out, we, you know, we got the emo tag a whole lot, and I think even since we've been a band, I don't really think anyone has known what emo is. You know, it's just changed so much since it first happened, you know, which I think was much more rooted in punk rock than it was in, like, you know, eyeliner and tight pants, you know. So it's weird to see people write about us as if we're like this established band, because we have three albums out, and I guess I don't always realize that that's like a large feat for a band, you know, especially a young band. It's really cool to get positive reviews that just kind of really are respectful and respectable. Like, feels like more people notice us for our music now than anything else, and I love that.
You're one of the few bands that can be on the cover of NME and Kerrang.
Oh yeah, sure. It's nice. It's cool to be recognized. I mean, there's always going to be people that kind of are skeptical of, you know, of us if we're coming from a place where we might have a song on the radio or two songs on the radio, and then we play with bands that, you know, aren't on the radio. I've definitely seen or heard, you know, a little bit, you know, like haters kind of say whatever they want, but for the most part, we have all kind of fans, and it kind of has been really cool to get respect from people all across the board, whether they're, you know, indie snob dudes or whether they're like just, you know, kids that are just getting into the scene and love music.
Do you think the indie snob dudes are surprised that you grew up listening to like Fugazi and Refused and people like that?
I don't know if that group of people would even know or realize our influences, because maybe they wouldn't look into it, you know. I mean, That's what I hope when we play, and that's why I love playing festivals and being able to do interviews with magazines or papers that are outside of like our little world, because I want people to, you know, I know for me, I love learning about bands, even bands that I don't necessarily, you know, think that I care about. You know, I just like kind of the history of everything and seeing where things come from. And for us, like, we play the kind of music we play, which from time to time, like, it's at its best is pop music, and that's what we love, but it comes from a place that is entirely different. You know, we all like the indie scene and the post-hardcore, like anywhere from mid to late 90s into the early 2000s is what we're really passionate about. And you know, I'm not sure if everyone outside of our fan base really knows that.
And coming up later on Radio 1, it's the Scott Mills Show. That's Paramore. Rebecca talking to Hayley Williams, the front person. Let's have a little chat about Paramore, Rebecca. How would you describe them? I mean, she was coming out with all kinds of influences there.
To me, they're just a big pop band. They're, like she says, they're pop punk. And I think I've spoken to her before, and it's quite interesting that when they were starting out, they tried to market her as a kind of Avril Lavigne type, because she's been doing it since she was 15. They've
right.
been a band, a like working, functional band since they were 15. And they wanted her to be like Avril Lavigne, and she wasn't really having any of it. She wanted to be in a band. So I think they're more credible than that kind of pop thing, but essentially it comes from the same kind of thing. I think they have the same sort of appeal, but slightly cooler kids will be into them.
You said you saw them live.
I did.
Was there anybody there over 16?
My friend.
you and your friend. Yeah.
There were some older chaps who I think had different reasons to be
there. I was
going to
say, did they look like they should be on some kind of government register?
Possibly.
Would the news of the world...
Emo pedos.
News of the world should start a campaign to name and shame those men, I think. But I mean, mostly it's little ones, is it?
Yeah, I think it's like 14-year-old girls who feel empowered by the stuff that... Because the stuff they're singing about is kind of nicely angry, like it's crosser authority and things like that. But in a really kind of... If I was 13, 14, I imagine I would be like, yeah.
I think actually we're laughing at this, and I don't think we should be, because I think that's actually a really, really valid thing for a band to be doing. And clearly they're not aimed at me, and they're not aimed at you, and they're not aimed at Rosie, or, you know, I imagine most listeners to this podcast, you know, they're not aimed at. But that is a really, really good function, to provide 14-year-old girls with something to listen to that's got a bit of heft behind it. It's a bit meaty. It's not, you know, a bunch of blokes sitting on stools singing no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And their fan base is rabid. Like, they are so obsessed with them. They're really, really into it. And you can see that they have a real impact on them. So, yeah, I'm with you.
Rosie, you were down with the Speed Garage scene at that age.
Yeah.
You were drinking champagne from the bottle twice as nice. But had you not been doing that,
would I have been
You have been into this kind of thing?
Probably because it's angsty, and I was into Tori Amos too. Always been multifaceted. Yeah. What middle class teenage girl isn't into Tori Amos? Wasn't into Tori Amos. Obviously, that I don't feel much musical connection to them now. And when she was talking about some of the bands that they're influenced by, who I do like, those hardcore bands like Fugazi that she mentioned, I don't really hear that. What I hear is how that American punk hardcore sound has been totally mutated over the years, and basically blame Green Day. And now what you get on the other side, it just feels incredibly poppy.
It feels like Drive Time rock to me.
Yeah,
I mean,
it feels
like, you know what I mean? Not that different from sort of AOR or whatever.
But the point that you made about it being important for teenage girls to have something with a bit of heft is huge, because, you know, when I've been at Reading and Leeds, which is where I saw Paramore, of course. The only other band who had a female fronted hard rock band at that point was, I can't remember the name of Brody Dahl's new band.
Spinnerette
with Brody Dahl, and that's it. And Brody Dahl's been on the scene for years. And so it's like, generationally, she's on her, you know, Hayley's on her own in doing that. And so it is quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's a massive trench of young girls who like metal. I mean, there is, you know, I mean, the Kerrang readership, I know for a fact, is kind of quite female slanted, and it seems odd that there are not more girls getting up and doing it for themselves, I think. So more power to your elbow, Hayley Williams. Don't listen to the haters drinking on the haterade when you're in town. If you want to experience the Paramore explosion in the flesh and look like you're on some kind of government register, you can catch them at the Leeds Reading Festival in August, where they appear second on the bill. A frankly catastrophic bill, I have to say, Leeds and Reading this year. Limp Bizkit, Blink 182. What year is it? I know.
Oh dear.
They still have the weird guy that looks like a monkey playing the guitar. Wes. Wes was amazing. Wes was like the Brian Eno of Limp Bizkit. What a thing to be. Anyway, let's move on. And here we are. We've arrived at Singles Club, where, as usual, we'll be sinking our teeth into recent or forthcoming releases. First up, it's a track from Rosie. Bloody hell. That's great, isn't it? That was Drunk Girls from LCD Sound System. Not merely a comeback single from a hugely critically respected band. I think it seemed to be sort of general consensus that Sound of Silver was pretty much the album of the decade, I think. But that, to me, sounds like a big old hit.
Yes. In fact, there's a track on the album called You Wanted a Hit, which is all about, you know how he loves his ironic song
titles. Absolutely, yeah.
Losing my head. But actually, what we talked last week with respect to Fang Island about sincerity. And
I listened to Fang Island's album, by the way. It's bloody awful from start to finish.
Right,
sorry.
Okay.
There you go. Anyway.
So still a thumbs down.
Still a thumbs down, yeah.
But we were talking, we couldn't tell in that instance. You couldn't tell whether they were sincere, and you were appalled that they actually were. And I think one thing that James Murphy does brilliantly is his songs actually capture a sense of irony and are still sincere.
That's true.
When you first hear this, you're like, God, what is this? And it reminds me of the Beastie Boys song, Girls, 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 or whatever it's called.
Girls to do the dance.
It's awful, which obviously wasn't sincere, because back then they were raving sexists who liked to have girls in cages on stage. But he does that brilliantly in this song, and it sounds like a hit, and it's instantly...
Yeah.
Catchy.
Rebecca.
Yes.
Are you going to be sick to death of this? If this does become a big hit,
yes.
Are you going to be sick to death after the festival season of loads of people walking around going, Drunk Girls! You know,
possibly. It was one of my least favourite songs from the album when I first heard it, the first couple of times. Because it's the most straightforward. It's just, it's kind of, it is really straightforward. But it's grown on me, and now I really like it. And now I'm one of those people who's like, drunk girls. Yeah, so, yeah. I don't know.
It sounds, I remember that a few years ago at Glastonbury, it was Gay Bar. I mean, this is like Gay Bar, only crucially not shit, I think is the
But do you actually know what he's talking, what is he talking about?
Is he talking about being on tour and being tempted, or is that way too simple?
I don't know, the levels of conceptual irony.
There are some lyrics about halfway through where he seems to be saying, you know, if you're the sober man, you need to remember what's a good idea and what's not a good idea. But that could be a totally...
Cheers, Dad.
Yeah. It could be... Well, you know, I mean, I think it's probably more of a problem for a musician that goes on tour for the average... than the average man. He's probably talking to himself there.
Yeah, I suppose. Yes, okay, of course. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Anyway, right, well, that's a brilliant close lyrical reading of Drunk Girls by LCD Sound System. Let's draw that to a close. That's a track on the new album This Is Happening, which is out on May the 17th. And now we can hear Rebecca's track.
Me don't like boys that ain't jumbo. Yeah. One time bust a shot from my champion. Girls tell them guys supersize me a combo. No, I got the ammo. That's why I bulletproof the Lambo. In the Middle East on a camo. Running through the jungle, Rambo. Liberace's hangout. Swinging on the vine, mango. So call me Simba, little mama. Cause Mufasa couldn't stop a bitch. I flattened on that chopper. Just a Baba Lindsay. I got it, just me, Mr. Me.
That was Massive Attack by Nicki Minaj. Fascinating in that she's an American artiste.
She is.
And it's an American artiste audibly influenced by MIA.
I know.
Isn't that mental?
Isn't it just? Who'd
have thunk it? Tell me what you like about that song.
Well, so Nicki Minaj has been knocking around for a while doing guest raps on people's songs. She's done two this year that I really like. She was on Ludacris's My Chick Bad, which I almost picked, but I think it's probably been around for a bit too long now, and Usher's Lil Freak. And for me, she was the highlight of both of them. Her raps are pretty funny, and I really like her delivery. She's getting compared to Lil' Kim a lot because she's like cartoon sexy and she gets her boobs out. She gets her boobs out.
And how do you sort of get your boobs out?
I was mentally scanning pictures that I've seen of her and working out whether she's had. I think it's more that she wears pants, but Lady Gaga wears pants. So maybe she doesn't get her boobs out.
We all wear pants, remember? That's a selling point. She needs to come up with another one, frankly. I wear pants.
Pants as day wear.
So is she literally... I'm sorry to press the breasts issue, but I mean, is she literally performing topless? I mean, what are you saying?
No, she's not. I think we should clear this up. I think she is peddling a sexy image.
Right, okay.
But it's quite cartoony.
Cool. So Jessica Rabbit.
It's more... Yeah, Jessica Rabbit. So there is a bit of Lil' Kim in there, but it's not quite as... She started out doing that kind of really explicit, sexy stuff, and I think she's moved away from it slightly, and she's a bit funnier now. But this song, I love it. And again, it was one that grew on me. I was looking forward to hearing her first solo stuff. This is the first one that's been put out there, and I was slightly disappointed. There's a lot of Sean Garrett in, who I don't know anything about him, but he's quite prominent. But then I listened to it again, and then I listened to it again, and then I started getting the MIA thing. I think it's a bit Missy Elliott. It's quite fun. And I think there are some really great lines in there as well. There's one, I think we heard that bit where she goes, so call me Simba, little mama, because Mufasa couldn't stop a bitch. It's The Lion King. She's rapping about The Lion King.
That's amazing.
It's brilliant.
I really liked it. I think it sounds like a very forward-thinking production. It sounds pretty exciting. It sounds pretty different. Rosie?
I do like it, but I don't think it sounds that fresh. And I actually sort of did get the MIA, but to me it reminded me so much more of what Missy Elliott and Timbaland were doing together in the sort of early 2000s, which I don't have a problem with because I loved that what they did together so much. And actually, I think mainstream hip-hop has tended to wander away from being as weird as it was when he was at his best, for sure. And she was, you know, Missy Elliott was such a weird, you know, her raps were so weird. And I really like her flow, as, you know, cool people call
it. You
like
how she spits.
Yeah, I like how she spits. It's kind of like a growl.
She reminds me of DMX a bit.
Well, I think she's been compared to Foxy Brown and Lil' Kim a lot, partly because of the way she sounds and what she raps about, and partly because of the way she looks. And I am hoping that she gets away from the stuff that we've seen before and develops her weirder side,
yeah.
which I think she's got the potential to do. And I actually think it could do well in the mainstream as well. So fingers crossed. She's certainly the most interesting person on Young Money, I think.
Yeah, by far.
That's Massive Attack by Nicki Minaj. Out in the States now. We're not sure of the UK release date, I'm afraid. But it's all over the internet if you want to hear it. And this is my selection.
Ending. Let's watch the sun go down and plan a holiday for two. We'll go to Napoli by cloud so you can see the world I created just for you. I saw you standing on a street. I'd like to meet you, stop a while, give you a smile and say hello. I believe in miracles, oh, I believe in miracles, oh, I believe in miracles, don't
That was a reissue of Mark Carney's I Believe in Miracles, the original version of I Believe in Miracles, later, more famously, covered by the Jackson Sisters. That's coming out, in fact, out now, on a 7-inch single on Jazzman Records. I'll tell you why I picked that. There's two reasons why I picked that. One, because it's just amazing, about which we're not actually having a discussion because it just is. And two, because I think it's fascinating that even... I was totally unaware that was a cover version, and I'm sure someone's... At this very moment, sending in a little thing to the blogging. I didn't give it. But I mean, it isn't. It just simply isn't that well known. And I think it's amazing that in this day and age, when we appear to have excavated the past, you know, strip mined the past so thoroughly, you can still come up with a. You can still dig up a record like that that hardly anybody knows about, and is amazing. So that's why I picked it.
I can't see anything about him, about this Mark Carney.
Anywhere.
Nothing about him.
No.
Whatsoever, or what group he was with, or anything like that.
No, no. I must admit, I've drawn a bit of a blank as well.
So if anybody knows.
If anybody knows, if you're out there, Mark, if you're listening.
I recently watched a documentary, which I'm sure other people have seen, about the other Michael Jackson, who wrote
Blame It on the Boogie. Blame It on the Boogie, yeah,
which
yeah.
Which is just so weird that this white Englishman, who now lives in Germany and whose son had decided to make a documentary. And he was a little bit more of a prolific songwriter, so I don't know if Mark Carney was one of these people that's sort of away in a studio somewhere and had his, you know, parts of his better work lifted for other musicians. But I do like it, but I have to say I prefer the Jackson.
Really? That's interesting, because I think it's better than the Jackson Sisters version. It makes
Fine.
Me think... I think it's not unlike a sort of like Isley Brothers-ish sound, you know, sort of Summer Breeze. That
it's
kind
totally
of stuff.
Different. It's really beautiful, but I love the...
Yeah.
The drama of the Jacksons.
So. Okay,
all right,
fair
so one each.
One yeah. each. Rebecca?
Well, I do like it. I'd... So much unravelling of things that it wasn't to do in my mind. I had to get the Jackson Sisters and the Pointer Sisters separated.
Yeah.
And I Believe in Miracles separated from You Sexy Thing. All of this in my head was one entity. And
okay.
then when I listened to it, oh, yeah, that one. Oh, yeah, them.
Right. Okay.
So I was pleasantly surprised. It wasn't what I was expecting.
No, I mean, I gather we're meant to bring in kind of new music rather than stuff that, you know, is about 90 years old. But it's just the best thing I've heard all week. So there you go. I Believe in Miracles by Mark Carney is out now on 7-inch on Jazzman Records. I Believe in Miracles by Mark Carney is out now on 7-inch on Jazzman. Feedback time now on our tongue interview and discussion. Ellie Moose wrote, "Tar for the tongue, guys. Their set with Tanarawen at Glastonbury was one of the most brilliant things ever! ! Tanarawen had this wonderful, obscenely loud bass player who sporadically rumbled over everything, getting dirty looks off the more mature audience members. Not that he gave a shit. By this point, Tongue and Tanarawen had obviously gotten pretty chummy." This is a slightly weird sexual undercurrent to this message. The Tongue guy gifting the Tanarawen guitarist a Led Zepp cover to expertly tear apart Desert Style. Again, I'm not 1,000,000% on this detail. That's the trouble with herbal assistance, kids. I think a bit of herbal assistance may have gone into the writing of that that particular post. If I imagined the cover, please don't correct me, because it's one of my most favourite memories
That's
ever.
That's my favourite.
That's brilliant.
Ellie Lewis, might have made this up.
Yeah, I might have just completely invented this thing that I'm writing to you about. We like you, Ellie Moose. Write in, make up some other stuff and tell us about it. That's brilliant. Phil Jones, 87, commented on our other interview last week, which with Broken Bells. Danger Mouse is really competent. High praise indeed. But never seems to get the best out of the people he works with. Might not be his fault necessarily, but James Mercer is better in The Shins, CeeLo is better in Goody Mob, MF Doom was better in Mad Villain and Danger Doom, etc, etc. I think the middle of the road comment was spot on. Oh dear, JJ Scruff had concerns about last week's podcast though. Folktronica, Tracy Thorn and Broken Bells in the same pod? No wonder Alexis milked that strum and bass gag, inverted commas, about three times.
I thought it was funny.
I thought it was hilarious myself. Let's have something a bit more exciting next time. Well, we've got Paramore, mate. I hope you like that. My ears can only take so much coffee, music, table chatter. I do sort of take your point. It was kind of a mellow one. Last week. Keep those comments coming, please, ladies and gentlemen. Even if you've just made something up that you saw at Glastonbury where you were off your cake, write in and tell us about that if we want something better to do. guardian.co.uk/musicweekly is the place to do this, and please come and find us on Twitter and Facebook too. Last week brought the news that the hugely influential Malcolm McLaren had passed away at age 64. He's obviously best known for being the manager and architect of the Sex Pistols. But McLaren's influence can obviously also be seen in the worlds of fashion and art. And he's also partly responsible for bringing hip-hop culture to Britain. Rosie.
McLaren came up with the concept of the Sex Pistols after spending time with and managing the New York Dolls in the early 70s. So I thought it would be good to get Syl to talk about these days and get his memories of Malcolm. And first of all, I asked him why he thought McLaren was so good at making things happen.
He was brilliant in his ways of, trying to package everything. You know, I guess what he learned in the rag business, to put it all together and to hit you with a package, just like he did when he came back home, being inspired, what the New York Dolls had spawned in New York City, and he took that idea, and he loved the whole ripped shirt deal, and he could throw it together as a package, because he was a brilliant salesman, by the way. You could smell the show business in him.
And so, what was your reaction to the Sex Pistols? When did you first hear them?
Well, actually, the Sex Pistols was supposed to be my band, to be honest with you, because when we broke up in 1975 and all the guys had gone back home, and all through that time he was always telling me, oh, Sylvain, don't worry, there's all these kids that hang around in front of my wife's shop, and we could put a band together for you and all that kind of stuff, so I gave him my guitar and my piano to go back home to have me to whatever band he was going to throw together. But actually what happened was he wrote me this 7-page letter. Like, he included these photo booth photos inside this letter. Right now that letter is at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. It's on display. It kicks off the whole punk pavilion, and this letter goes on for 7 letters, like how I should come to England because this is my band, the Sex Pistols is my band, Sylvain. Come over here now. And he had, in the back of the pictures, it would be like, okay, we're thinking of calling this guy Johnny Rotten. He can't sing, but he could definitely sing better than David Johansen. And he would go on and on and on. It was really funny, it was really great. And I mean, I never made it, whatever, my career, I got signed to a record company over here in the States, and I never made too much money in this whole business, but inspiration wise I guess I'm number one, In like 83 or something like that, I was signed to in New York to Tommy Boy Records, which is a big rap company that put out African Bambaataa and a lot of the rap stuff, the early rap stuff, when you know, it was just called basically rap, and hip hop was just, you know, the words were just being invented, and he came over and kind of, you know, got so influenced by that whole scene and stuff, and came up with Buffalo Girls and all that. I mean, to the rap community, which was really small at that point, you know, and no one wanted to touch them, you know, no big labels wanted to touch them. I mean, he became their hero because he basically, again, put it on the map, you know. Sometimes it takes somebody maybe of, you know, with that vision that and has that opportunity and stuff, and Vivian, again, made the clothes for it, you know, and it was just, again, packaged really, really well and sold it, and I don't think it was just luck. It was just a smart cat, you know.
Nice to hear you, or, you know, interesting to hear you saying all these things about him as a person, because the public image that he had was, you know, he was quite scathing. You know, you'd probably be quite scared to attempt to interview him. He would, you know, he was challenging everything around him.
Well, you know what, though? In this business, it's a rat race, you know? It's a bastard of a business. And you've got to be a little bit like that. And you got to take your opportunities wherever they lay. You got to sock it to them and sort of, you know, put it between the grooves if you have to. And, you know, in his case, he didn't. And he could actually, it wasn't the Beat Generation moment. This was now, you know, the 70s, and you could actually maybe be a more, you know, yourself and tell them all, you know, well, to fuck off if you had to. I always thought that the most important musician in the Sex Pistols was actually Malcolm McLaren. You know, he was the biggest star in the Sex Pistols. They skip and jump through the loop. They might break and they might fall, but the girls from New York City don't. They just start again, start again. Hey,
Sylvain Sylvain of the New York Dolls there. And it's a sorry heart indeed that isn't a bit gladdened by the sound of Double Dutch by Malcolm McLaren, isn't it? What a fantastic record. It's interesting what he said in that interview, that he said he thought the biggest star in the Sex Pistols was Malcolm McLaren. I mean, I think Malcolm McLaren thought that as well. why do you think, Rosie, he was successful as the Sex Pistols manager?
Because he was successful at doing something slightly different, which was exposing the strings of the industry.
Interesting.
And, you know, he was an arch manipulator of the things around. You know, it doesn't feel that revolutionary anymore, but I think one of the things that you can't, you know, he made something which not a lot of people knew about transparent. Mm. And we also live in a time where you know so much about, yeah, you know, every band, and it's information overload and all that nonsense. So it feels like to have someone so in your face doing things in the way that he did it would never work after he'd done it, because he, yeah, because he exposed the strings.
I think that's really interesting, in that if you look at the sort of career of the Sex Pistols from the vantage point of 2010, it's really difficult to imagine anybody getting as upset as people did about a single. You know, I mean, people were really, really, really to the point where, you know, the Sex Pistols were attacked in the streets and stuff like that for making a record. You know, it just seems, it's kind of different times.
Especially,
you know,
a record, you know, that insulted the royal family.
I know. Amazing, you know. Because of the legacy of the Sex Pistols, obviously, Malcolm McLaren's own musical career tends to get overlooked. But in the early 80s, he was a big deal, I think, Malcolm McLaren. He had a succession of hits. He took influence from hip-hop, Sounds of Africa. He was voguing before Madonna too, and also most overlooked, I think, is his 1984 album Fans, which is a bold, there's not really anything else like it, an attempt to sort of meld electro and opera, which sounds ghastly, but in the case of what we're about to hear, is a single called Madame Butterfly, is astonishing.
Shall I run to him or run away? you take it out on the dance floor.
We heard in order there Malcolm McLaren's Madam Butterfly, Soweto, and Deep in Vogue. I mean, I have to say, I was listening to this stuff again this morning, and I was pretty gobsmacked by almost all of it. I think Soweto, if a sort of bunch of Brooklyn hipsters had put that record out last week, you wouldn't be in any way surprised. And this is a record that came out in 1982. So pretty remarkable. Deep in Vogue, definitely there before Madonna. I mean, the video looks an awful lot like Madonna's Vogue, which came out 6 months later. He was good. I mean, his skill clearly wasn't as a musician, but he was good at spotting ideas.
And a lot of the, you know, in the same way that Public Image Limited took their influences from dub, a lot of these, you know, him and them in particular, when you think of punk, it seems so white. So, you know, and so to have them doing something completely different and bringing in these influences from mainly from across the pond, really, but, you know, elsewhere was quite remarkable. But I also came to this stuff again after hearing the news. I thought, well, I'll go and, you know, listen to Double Dutch a lot before. I thought it was a brilliant record, but I hadn't gone that far into his back catalogue. And that's partly because I was so put off by the kind of person that he was. And I, like a lot of people, read about his escapades with Bow Wow Wow in Simon Reynolds' Rip It Up.
Yeah, and it's that not really, his finest moment, though.
No, and it, so, and it brought to mind, if you don't know, then it's a, there's a chapter in which Reynolds talks about Bow Wow Wow, which were essentially Adam and the Ants band, with this 13-year-old girl who Malcolm McLaren found, and they... He, you know, attempted to explain himself as saying he was trying to expose the way the music industry worked and exploited people, and in the process, very almost exploited a very young girl. And there's all these rumours about this magazine called Chicken, which is basically going to be child pornography, but he was going to somehow get the BBC to pay for it.
I mean, on one level, you know, this is reprehensible. On another level, it is, you know, it's, you know, in, hell
as
of a
an
scam.
Idea, exactly, hell of a scam, and as an idea, it's a great swindle. But you know, there was a child involved here who was put naked on the, you know, so it's all that kind of stuff. So it was quite reprehensible in that way, and it made me think of the other great Svengali of our recent times, Tony Wilson, and the outpouring of affection that happened when he died, which I haven't really felt when McLaren died. There's been a lot of tribute to him, but I don't think it's been a great deal of affection.
Yeah, I think it's possibly more to do with respect for his achievements rather than, although, I mean, I interviewed McLaren once, and absolutely amazing. I rang his office, and he picked the phone up, and I had my questions. I said, oh, hi, Malcolm, I'm a journalist, I'm calling about this. And I got halfway through my question, and he talked uninterrupted for 90 minutes. It was only bettered by a friend of mine who attempted to interview Pete Waterman while she had a terrible case of cystitis. And at one point just went to Pete Waterman, look, I've got really bad cystitis. I'm going to go to the toilet.
You and carry on. Piss.
You just keep talking to my dictaphone. I'll be back in a bit. And she came back like 20 minutes later. Pete Waterman is still gabbing on. I think what's interesting is the hip-hop thing is I remember the Buffalo Gals video being on Top of the Pops, and it certainly wasn't the first hip-hop record that had been heard in Britain, because Rapper's Delight had been before that. I think The Message was around the same time. But it was definitely the first time that you saw breakdancing and graffiti and things like that. I remember the, you know, surprise caused by seeing people breakdancing on the telly. I mean, it is amazing. It's difficult to find. Both Duck Rock and Fans, as far as I know, are out of print. You can probably find them if you type in Duck Rock or Fans Blogspot. I'm sure somebody's put them up on their blog. They are really, really worth checking out. Wholehearted recommendation for both of them from me. And yeah, that's that, really. That was Malcolm McLaren, who, of course, died last week, aged 64. And that's all for this week's pod. Rebecca, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks.
See you soon, I hope.
Yep.
Excellent. Rosie.
Yes.
Till next time.
Till next time.
My thanks also to producer Pete, as ever. I'm Alexis Petridis. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.